I literally just remember thinking, I can't do another day. It's impossible. It's an impossibility. I'm that exhausted. I literally have no energy left. Like, if I could have, like, pushed a button and evaporated, I just would have.
Whether it's the clothes you wear to work or a metaphor for putting up a front, we all wear a uniform. But often there's a lot going on behind the uniform, and many of us are reluctant to express how we are really feeling.
Each week on Behind the Uniform, Dr. Izzy Smith and Captain Hugo Tovey will be joined by a special guest as they talk openly and honestly about their experiences with mental health. Nothing will be off limits, so prepare yourself for tears, laughter and goosebumps. Hello and welcome to Behind the Uniform podcast. My name is Izzy Smith and as always I'm joined by my co-host Hugo Tovey, who is looking great today, kitted out in activewear, which is a bit different.
I know. No, it is interesting, Izzy. I'm actually here today in my my runners and my activewear, and you're the one who's actually just come from a bit of a lunch, and you're the one sort of dressed up for a change, which is nice to see.
How's your week been going?
It's been good. Good start to the week. I was had a bit of a difficult week last week, actually. We had to put our dog down, unfortunately, which is always sad. So that sort of hit my partner quite a lot. People who know dogs can appreciate that dogs are basically like a family member, and for us, that was definitely the case with Iggy. So that's been pretty difficult, emotional type week. But apart from that, I've tried to take a bit of time off, went back home to Adelaide, and it was my birthday last week too, so I celebrated a bit of a birthday. So it's actually been an eventful week since I sort of saw you last. Is
I was going to say that is a lot, and I kind of know that all of them have been happening when you put it all together.
All right, busy. How about you? How's your busy week of night shifts?
First, I want to say I'm sorry about Iggy. I know he was really with you through your cancer journey, so that would represent a lot, and he actually had bowel cancer as well, is
that
right?
Yeah, he did have a bit of a cancer near his bum area, and I think eventually that started to spread a bit and got the better of him. But no, you're right, he was definitely by my side, and he was kind of my recovery dog in a way, so he will definitely miss him, but that's okay. We still have little Ernie, so Ernie's getting extra cuddles now in bed, so he's getting just as much attention, which is good. You got your game face on, and we've got a pretty exciting episode and a pretty inspiring guest with us today, and I'll give you the honours of introducing him.
You're exactly right, and I'm so excited about this episode, maybe because I know this person a little bit better than, well, actually much better than our other guests, but I know his story and he's so inspiring, and I'm just, so excited to share it and that he's come and made the time today. So I'll cut to the chase. We have a fellow Movember ambassador today. His name is Dan Price, or he's fondly known as Pricey. He's a keynote speaker in the mental health world. He's, he's also a devoted husband and father of two. He's an ultra runner, which is how I first met him. And he does all of this on top of a corporate job. But I guess with what the theme of this podcast is about, he's an absolutely inspiring story of what can be on the other end of absolutely hitting rock bottom. He's also a great example and advocate that mental health isn't a destination, it's an ongoing journey. So with all of that, Dan, thank you so much for coming in today.
Thank you. Thank you, Izzy. That was a very nice intro. Thanks, Hugo. Thanks for having me. And no, condolences on the loss of your dog, mate. That must have been very hard.
No, thanks, Dan. No, it is actually. It's it's really great to finally meet you in person, mate. I feel like I've known you well without meeting you in person, and I've we've got a bit of a Movember ambassador WhatsApp chat, and I follow your journey and what you've been up to, and look, you do have an inspiring story, and even doing a bit more sort of research into you, that in itself has been amazing. But yeah, mate, it's good to finally meet you in person.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for having me.
No, anytime, mate. And look, before we kind of get into your story side of things, like we do with all our guests, we just want to sort of start off by asking Dan Price, or Pricey, what you're doing when you are your happiest, mate.
Yeah, I love that question. And, it would have to be playing with my two-year-old daughter for sure. It's interesting. I experienced missing her, really deeply missing her for the first time just last week, because I was so busy with Movember stuff and work, and I'm always home in the afternoons to bath and feed her. And it was about a 48-hour period that I hadn't seen her, because I'm up so early and out. And it got to about 3 o'clock on the second day, so it was like a Thursday, and then Friday afternoon came around, And I was like, geez, I just can't wait to get home to see her. And I just thought that was really cool. And obviously, she's at that age now where I'm having conversation with her. And, you know, she gets super excited when I'm home, runs and gives me big cuddles. And, you know, so she's like a little friend now, like a little mate.
That's Tallulah, is
that? Tallulah, yeah. So, you know, that's definitely when I'm at my happiest, for sure. Wonderful. At the moment. Yeah.
And then you've got another young boy called Sunny.
Sunny, yeah. Sunny's 6 weeks old.
Hands full, mate.
Yeah, very much so. Yeah, not as full as my partner Sarah at home, but yeah, they're pretty full.
Love it, mate.
And I love that, Dan. And you know, I've known you for a bit over a year now, and you're such a devoted dad. And I really love that you recognise your wife all the time and what she sacrifices and you know, does to support you. So, you know, being the woman here, I just love that. Now, before we get started into the episode and podcast today, I do just want to do a trigger warning and mention that we're going to be talking about some pretty heavy stuff today, you know, including suicide, but that's what this podcast is about. It's asking the uncomfortable questions that we need to start talking about to, you know, change stigmas and change losing people. But with that in mind, there are some really heavy topics, so it might be a good episode to maybe listen to with a friend and talk about some of the concepts or even break it into two parts. Without further ado, though, I might get Hugo to get started.
No, thanks. Isn't it an important thing to say? And love that thing, mate, that like you're touching on with being with family and being with your daughters when you're at your happiest. I love that. And it, we have touched on it. It's been a common sort of theme with a lot of our guests, that often family and friends, and you know, they're the sort of the most important sort of parts and what makes them happiest, which is wonderful. And sort of talking about, you know, family, you know, bit about you growing up, I suppose, and if we can sort of just get a capture a bit of a story before we get into sort of your 20s and your 30s and sort of what you're up to now. What was your sort of growing sort of during school days, teenage years, and sort of those days, looking back on it, who were you as a person, and what were some of the sort of the struggles that you faced?
Yeah, when I share my story, I started when I was 7. So now I do. It took me a while to piece it together, actually, in therapy as to sort of when I started to struggle. And I'm a middle child of three, just to give you that background. Close family. My parents are still together. You know, lots of love and support around. But for whatever reason, I think from as early as I can remember, I didn't really feel like I fit in. I'm not quite sure what that was. I think some people are just born that way, feel like a bit of a misfit. I was diagnosed with ADHD at 7, which, you know, was a pretty challenging experience to go through. You know, the way I received that whole conversation that, you know, my parents were having with my teachers and that sort of thing in primary school was, you know, that there's something wrong with me, and I was taken off to therapists and specialists and had caps put on my head in these rooms with noises and, you know, with microphones on like we've got on today and beeps and sounds and like a science experiment, you know, and it's quite traumatic. You know, I only in the last couple of years unpacked the trauma around that diagnosis and the tests and everything. But that really shaped my life, you know, because getting that diagnosis and not getting much information about what it meant, I just felt like I had something wrong with me and I had to take medication to fix it. And being a kid that's taking medication and the other kids in class finding out and teachers not really treating me, certainly not with enough empathy or understanding, still sending me out of class for fidgeting and talking and being picked on for taking medication. I even had, you know, other students' parents in the classroom ask me to stay away from their kids. Like, and I wasn't a naughty kid. Like, I've never been in trouble with the law. You know, I didn't hurt anyone ever. You know, I was literally just a kid with too much energy that didn't like being in the classroom. Like, and I was an amazing athlete. So I guess that's the background is, you know, a young Dan Price was super energetic and hyperactive, real outdoors kid. You know, there's a video of me at just walking, hitting a ping pong ball with a ping pong racket against the wall, like volleying it. You know, I was a great tennis player as a kid, so I was just that way inclined, real sports star. And there was just, yeah, really early on a real divide in my personality between the kid no one wanted to sit next to in class and the kid that everyone wanted on whatever team, whether it be netball, touch footy, you know. Yeah, so it was a real tough upbringing, really, in that regard, and getting bullied and things like that.
How was that as a child with the other people, and did that carry on to your teenage years?
Yeah, it's the biggest theme, I think, that I unpacked in my therapy, or have unpacked, you know, it took a while to get there too, was this need for external gratification to feel like I was good enough and I belonged. And, you know, that was formed through the only time I felt accepted was on the sports field. And when I was on the sports field, I was the best and I was winning and I was, you know, scoring tries. And so, very early on, there was that conflict and also a really toxic behaviour on the other end, where I didn't share that I was being bullied ever. You know, my parents didn't even know the hard time I had until I told them, you know, in the last few years. So, like, I'm 35.
Wow. Did you know that it was obviously not a normal thing to go through?
Yeah, look, I did. I felt quite uncomfortable at school, and I certainly think that I was suffering some sort of, you know, adolescent anxiety for sure. Like, it's not normal to be, you know, have butterflies in your stomach in the morning on the way to school, I don't think.
Not at all.
And, you know, and I just didn't really enjoy the experience. You know, I was just not treated like I belonged. And I think, to be perfectly honest, it wasn't that direct either. I think it was quite subtle, which made it even harder for me to recognize. Like, it wasn't like I was picked on and bullied all the time. It was just a little thing here and there, but it was always about the same part of me. And it was that part of me that I was already struggling with and ashamed of.
Post-school, how did that impact you, what you wanted to do for your future? Because, you know, a lot of us are getting to those, you know, year 10, 11 and 12, and it's all about, what are you going to do post-school? I want to do this, I want to do that, I want to be a doctor, I want to join the army, whatever that might be. But for you, did you have those career aspirations and what you wanted to do? And then what did you decide to do when you eventually kind of got out of that school bubble?
Yeah, I think, well, I went to a boarding school that had a huge sporting history. You know, like, rugby was religion. Funnily enough, I didn't play rugby, so that was another one. Playing soccer at a rugby school was interesting in itself. But, I wanted to be a professional athlete, you know. It came to the party way too late. You know, I excelled at a couple of sports late and played sport at uni as well, but was never going to make it. You know, you've kind of got to turn the corner at about 10 these days. So I went to uni and did business and property economics. I had an interest in real estate, just really through my dad's interest. He's not a property developer or real estate agent by definition, but he's done a bit in that area. He's really a businessman. He's got a couple of businesses that are all sort of random. He's got a medical center. He's got a signage business. But I just, I had an interest in business and property because of my dad, and probably got steered that way by him, which, isn't uncommon. The other thing on my list was sports science, believe it or not, and it's probably where, if I'd go back, I don't have no regrets, but if I went back again, I'd probably give that sort of area a crack because, you know, as you'll hear from, as my story goes on, it's something that's just part of who I am. It's in my DNA.
But you then went down that property pathway, but you were pretty bloody good at it, and you were... You know, whatever, you know, I want to say the word successful, but obviously with inverted commas, because obviously depending what you define success as, but you had that, you know, that house, the sports car, the watch, you know, the money coming in at a young age too. And then I believe during all of that, you also got married pretty young. So I suppose in your early 20s, from the outside in, it looked like you probably had a pretty successful life.
Yeah, it did. You know, I even remember mates... and this is where the change really happens. You know, I had a lot of mates going, Brycey, you know, look at you. Look at what you got. Like, you're killing it. You know, like, I literally, you know, felt like a number of my mates were looking up to me. And that was a nice feeling, you know, but I had really pushed the envelope on the perfectionist, like, rushing life type thing. I think looking back and reflecting, I was just trying to get everything done quickly.
It can be pretty... detrimental because it can put unrealistic expectations on yourself, and then if you don't achieve something, you think you're failing, which I found personally. But from the sounds of it, when you were going through that, you had that perfectionism, and you just drove that drove you, I suppose, to all your during your career.
Yeah, it did, absolutely. And I think one of the issues with having that perfectionism trait being very strong and at front of mind all the time for anyone, certainly for me, is it's unsustainable, right? And not just the constant achieving, but the trajectory at which you're achieving. You know, it's going to flatline. And if you're a perfectionist, flatlining your trajectory of achievement makes it feel like you're failing.
You're failing, yeah.
Because your numbers aren't as good anymore at the office if you're in a sales role, which I was, or whatever it is. So, you know, it's a recipe for disaster at some point. You're going to reach, you know, that crash and burn, feeling like you're a failure, implosion, burnout, that sort of area, which is without the right skills and self-care strategies or support network, you know, it's going to be, pretty ugly, really, or detrimental, so for sure.
And then when did you get married, mate, during...
believe it or not, it wasn't that long ago, but I can't remember if I was 24 or 25. I'm pretty sure I was 24.
So
it was early. I was engaged at 21.
Early 20s, engaged at 21, married at sort of 24, 25.
Yep.
And at that stage, you know, you had the wife, you had the house, as I touched on, the car, you had that job, like you said, you had your mates on the outside saying, "Pricey, mate, like bloody hell, you've got this enviable life," and you were just living the dream for a lot of people, right? Yeah. And then I suppose this is the pivotal part of your story and something we're about to explore now is then when did it kind of, you know, come to a halt? When did things start to kind of spiral down?
And how was your mental health in that time? You've said you were on a journey, but in those years when you looked really successful, how were you mentally?
Yeah, look, I definitely had a few of those perfectionist-driven burnouts. You know, because the achievements weren't quite there. I was doing way too much. Just pushing too hard. You know, I don't know what my adrenals would have been like, but they would have been shot just talking from a health perspective, you know, just constantly on. And I was the high achiever in everything. So I was up early. I was a gun in the gym. I was still playing high-level soccer. So I was just burning the candle at all ends and had no idea about self-care and balance.
Mm-hmm.
I'd never lived my life that way. I certainly had never sat down to really look at, you know, what was driving me, what my behaviours were, and I had no mental health education, no education around self-care, balance. It was really, all I was surrounded by was people pushing themselves to the limit.
But did you still enjoy, obviously, parts of that, climbing the corporate ladder and driving the car and going out partying with your mates and, you know, no doubt alcohol and all this type of stuff and socialising? Like, I'm sure there are still parts of that where you enjoyed, but that was almost in a way kind of masked everything else. And like you said, the whole sustainable part, you're not going to live that life forever.
No, that's right. Yeah. And, there was an interesting first kind of dip in my mental health that I've unpacked recently. And it was this transition where I went from, you know, being like an athlete playing soccer to having a few injuries and then also getting a couple of promotions at work. So the workload was increasing. So I'm like the youngest associate director of this firm, a lot more responsibility, bigger targets. So I pulled away from the soccer. But then I think I also, for whatever reason, was aware that I was feeling a little bit disconnected, doubting myself a little bit again, and I went full tilt headfirst into bodybuilding, right? And I think it was probably a little bit about my relationship at home and probably not getting much attention there. We were growing apart in my, you know, marriage only a couple of years in. By this stage, I'm talking like I'm 26, 27. Mm-hmm. Probably 27. And, you know, I just got massive. And I remember personal training.
I've seen the photos.
Like, yeah.
I'm like, who is that person?
Yeah. And I remember like personal trainers and stuff saying like, why, which is another, this is a whole nother problem, this question, but why are you getting so big in the gym? Like you're married, you know, like what are you doing that for? You know, because their obviously perception was guys get big for attention from women, right? Which is a whole nother problem. But it was interesting that I didn't know why I was doing it. I just thought that I wanted the challenge to get big and strong, but there was a huge self-esteem element to that I wanted some sort of attention because I wasn't getting it at home, you know. Mm. I wasn't getting much external gratification and love and all that stuff, and so obviously in my mind I was like, well, maybe if I get fitter and bigger and stronger and stuff, I'll be more manly. And you know, and this is all subconscious, like it was never like a plan that I wrote down,
of course, and
just
that's,
came from somewhere,
you know,
else.
We're kind of avoiding our reality by distracting ourselves with something else. And we said, you know, some people it might be alcohol, some people it might be aggressive behaviours. Usually when we are going through a trauma or some kind of, you know, suffering or pain, if we don't recognise that and, you know, face it, we externalize our issues and it presents in other ways. So, you know, so much of, you know, everything that we do, you can kind of analyze and relate it back to something else. However, the issue is none of this is bloody talked about until we hit rock bottom and do the 100 hours of therapy.
No, that's absolutely right, you know, and yeah, it became a full-blown addiction for me, the gym. I would get stressed if I was missing sessions. I would turn up
late. That perfectionistic personality.
Yeah, I'd miss you know, family birthday dinners, or I'd go late to get my gym sessions in. I wouldn't eat at restaurants if they didn't cook without oil. Like, it became a full-blown obsession. It was like, I don't want to say it's like OCD because I wasn't diagnosed OCD, but I was very, very obsessive. Well, I was weighing my food.
You know, that's an eating disorder.
Yeah, I had body dysmorphia or megorexia or whatever you want to call it, absolutely.
Do you mind me asking, were you taking steroids at this time?
I didn't. I thought about it a lot. Thankfully, and at this time I wasn't drinking much alcohol, and I never had. I'd never experimented with any recreational drugs. I was super healthy, which came from my ADHD really
super healthy
diet.
In inverted commas.
Right, yeah, in inverted commas, right? So, yeah, so that was something that, you know, crossed my mind because I'd plateaued, right? I hit this thing where my body couldn't get any bigger or stronger because I'm not a big guy. You know, I was really skinny at small. I've got small wrists, and you know, like I got a small frame. I'm not a big, broad guy. I'm only 5'9" and a bit. So, you know, I was like 88 kilos of muscle. Like, I'm 74 now, so I was enormous. It just didn't make sense. But I was just addicted to the point that I couldn't take that any further. And then it lost its buzz. And it, like Izzy said, all I was doing was, without really realizing, I was like, what's something that I can cling to that is going to distract me from what I'm actually feeling?
Yeah. It's probably an important thing for people listening is that, you know, there are different types of addictions. You know, it's not always drugs and alcohol. And for you, it still wasn't a safe addiction. You know, in a way, it was you just, you know, escape, that whole escapism from something else. And that probably did lead into, you know, fortunately, you did get divorced at 28, I understand.
Yep.
So at that stage, I feel like you were just talking about before when your life was really up, you know, going up, up, up. Everything was looking great. You know, you had, all of a sudden, things just started to unrail a little bit. And I suppose when you eventually divorced and went through that, was there, looking back on it, a particular moment you thought things were really starting to look bad? Or was it kind of a thing started to progressively get worse?
Yeah, I think it was definitely a slow process. You know, so the... I think by about, it was probably 29. I was 29 when we separated, but we had a period of about 12 months of marriage counselling. You know, it's really tough, you know, when you've been with someone since you were 17 and you can't work it out, and lots of other things are pointed to as the problem. And, you know, in therapy at the time, and I've never spoken about this, but I'm happy to share, you know, that things like your job isn't the right job for you were kind of brought up. And, I just felt like everything was pointed to me as, you need to change your life. I was like, well, you know, I've worked so hard for this job. I don't think the job's the problem. And, you know, the reality was it was just a relationship that was unsustainable because we'd really grown our separate ways. We'd been together since 17. We had really different core values, different family, you know, reality of what family was. We came from very different family systems and different, you know, values and everything because of that. So
and did your ex-wife know, you know, what you're going through then? Were you expressing your emotions then? Were you talking about things?
No.
Were you still very closed with yourself?
I was extremely closed, and that, you know, that wouldn't have been easy, but she was similar, very, very unemotive in terms of the way, you know, we communicated. It was quite rigid and, you know, fairly...
Businesslike?
You know, yeah, a bit businesslike. Yeah, not very... Certainly not open, put it that way. Yeah, so it was an interesting time, but the wheels did certainly start to fall off, and it was a slow process, to get back to your question. Through that whole relationship breakdown, you know, I felt like a failure. Like, some really big feelings started coming up. Shame, failure, what are people going to think of me if I leave? You know, I was staying because I was worried about what people were going to think if I left. But I knew I needed to leave because it was unsustainable. So I left, the hardest decision I've ever had to make in my life. To this day, at that moment in time, it was just excruciating. You know, and to move home, as a 29-year-old, a very successful, in inverted commas again, 29-year-old, that had everything, back to my parents' place. And I literally remember lying in bed in my parents' house feeling like the 29 years were just a waste and I didn't know what to do. Like, what am I going to do? Like, I've lost it all. And the reality was, like, I hadn't lost anything. I hadn't lost really any of my friends. You know, there were going to be some of my friends that I wasn't going to be able to socialize with for a while because they were kind of my ex-wife's friends, that sort of thing. But the reality was I had all my friends, all my family, had a roof over my head. I still had my job. I hadn't lost any of my material possessions or wealth, really. You know, it's combined wealth. So, yeah, we're going to go through that process. But in my head, it was like I didn't know what to do. And again, coming back to this theme, I still was not sharing how I was feeling. And, you know, I look back and realize now I didn't know how. Like, I think at that point I probably wanted to, but I'd buried my emotions my whole life so long that I just had no idea how to do it, and there were so many barriers to doing it.
Yeah, this podcast, Dan, is called Behind the Uniform. That metaphorical uniform, whether you know, it's the mask, the uniform, whatever. But from the sounds of it, you know, you had your corporate suit on, and you know, you're living that life, but you're probably ultimately hiding behind that uniform. And I suppose when you were at your mum's, living back at home on the couch, you know, regardless of the wealth and everything else you had, it feels like the uniform was taken off. And then that's when you sort of felt vulnerable and thought, you know, fuck me, what am I doing now? And then that's when things probably started to realize what was going on.
Yeah, absolutely. It was, you know, there were some very lonely times, you know, just realizing that, you know, I think subconsciously what was happening was I needed myself. I needed a relationship with myself and I didn't have one. So I was so alone.
Being with your partner since you were 17 as well.
Yeah.
And from this period, you know, this led to what I would assume is your kind of rock bottom, is my understanding. Can you tell us about what happened?
Yeah, sure. So by this point, I'm certainly struggling with depression. I'd struggled with anxiety and probably some panic attacks at times. During my 20s, I'd say. There were certainly some moments during big projects and stuff at work where I'd have sweats and be really freaking out, like a bit more than just stress. So, but then it got really extreme. You know, my panic attacks, which I didn't know they were panic attacks, I thought I was sick. Like, I actually thought I was really run down. I remember thinking, I'm just really run down and this is going to blow over. But I was having full body sweats, vomiting. It was quite extreme, yeah. My anxiety got so bad that I couldn't have anyone walk behind me. Like, I had this really weird, like, fear of, you know, just having, I used to have to stand against the wall. You hear this, I don't know where it comes from, maybe Izzy knows, but you hear people with social anxiety need to stand with their back against the wall so they can see the room. I don't know what that is, but it's a bit of a fear thing.
I can imagine it's something to do with feeling safe because you can't see what's behind you and it would be some kind of primal instinct.
Yeah, so it was pretty extreme and something, again, being a bloke that at this point, you know, hadn't been to hospital and all that sort of stuff, never went to the doctor, never took Panadol for a headache, you know, that sort of thing, like, literally. I was just like, I'll tough it out. You know, I remember thinking to myself, I'm sick. I thought I was run down. Like, I started trying to do a bit less. But the reality was I was so far gone, you know, in terms of being run down. I was way past burnout. I was extremely depressed, you know, struggling to sleep because of the anxiety and stress. And that was then just snowballing into my day of anxiety. You know, as you know, if you're struggling with both anxiety and depression, they really feed each other. They certainly did for me. And the more anxious I became, the less I could sleep. And then the less energy I had the next day, and then the more exhausted I'd feel, which didn't help my ability to fight off any of the depressed feelings to motivate myself to do anything self-care wise.
And it seemed like it was just going downhill and things were just kind rapidly going downhill. And I suppose if, you know, your mates were standing there or your family and they asked, hey, Dan, Pricey, mate, now how are you? Even though you're in those midst of those serious mental health or mental illness struggles, you know, what would you say when people would say, how are you going?
Yeah, I was professional at saying I was fine. And I think it got to the point where I was convincing myself I was all right. Like, I was believing my own bullshit. I really was, that I was going to be okay. Like, I just, it's like, you know, my need to be positive and that power of positivity and trying to manifest, you know, a way out was just becoming so toxic.
Toxic positivity.
Yeah, it was just
ignoring what's really going on in your life.
It was just bullshit. Yeah, totally. It was just complete denial. But I needed to not be sick because I didn't understand it. So I was just like, nothing's wrong with me. I'm going to be okay. You know, and all these things around mental health and stigma that we talk about were there for me. Like, you know, I can't tell people I'm actually feeling this way. Like, you know, like I remember thinking how strange it was that I'd be crying in the mornings. Like I'd cry putting my suit on because it was like this almost traumatic experience that I'd have to go into that environment that was causing me so much stress.
Put your uniform on. Mm.
Totally. You know, and I just, and that was that whole just wanting to isolate. I wanted to be on my own. Like my depression was obviously very strong at that point where I just didn't want to be outside. I didn't want to be socializing. I didn't want to get out of my bedroom, that sort of thing. But I kept going to work.
But you didn't talk about how you're feeling.
Didn't talk about it, no. Mm. And very quickly, from that point of, you know, really struggling with my mood, like to even get out the door. And by this point, nothing that used to bring me joy was bringing me any joy at all, whether it was a big deal at work. You know, I was still performing reasonably well at work. You know, and that's that high-functioning depression.
Isn't that crazy to think when you're talking about how you're literally crying, you had those panic attack episodes, you know, you're seriously struggling, but then once you put your game face on, put the suit on, you could still perform at work to a high standard. And yeah, like people probably look at that on the outside, and that's why someone who might be severely depressed or severe anxiety, when you see them in a work setting or, you know, out and about, it's not always the obvious signs when you see them, and clearly that was the case with you.
Yeah, totally. And, you know, for people that it does, you know, their illness does manifest in that way, I think, you know, the effort that goes into turning up, what happens at the other end is certainly for me is it just, you know, the drop-off at the end of the day is so severe, and it gets more severe and more severe until you have, for me, these like mini burnouts, like these mini breakdown episodes. On the very slippery slope to complete rock bottom, you know, and they were coupled with excessive drinking to try and put myself to sleep, or self-medicating, you know, and just to paint a picture for the listeners, you know, it got so bad for me that I was telling my parents I was staying with mates, and telling my mates I was staying at my parents' still, and I was sleeping in my car behind my office building in the city. So I'd work late until everyone was gone. I'd go and hit the beers, maybe socialise with a few people, and then literally go and stay in my car because I just felt it's really weird looking back now because I don't really understand how that turned a corner so much that there was so much shame within me that someone might find out how I was feeling that I just didn't want to be around anyone. Like it was a combination of how deep the depression was and how socially anxious I was. And I was worried that I was going to get asked the questions. It was really hard to keep deflecting them. So I was just, it was like extreme isolation, you know, extreme in the sense that I was, you know, I had so many places to go and I was like literally kind of living out of my car.
And yeah, like even hearing that, it's the fact you could get in that place. And then I suppose you touched on the rock bottom side of things and, you know, 4th of December 2014, I suppose that was your rock bottom. And you just want to kind of, for the listeners, explain, obviously, that snowball effect we spoke about. It finally got to a stage and you got to the crisis point, if you want to call it that. And you just want to talk the listeners through that particular day, 4th December 2014.
Yeah, I can. I still remember it, obviously, very clearly. It was a night I'd spent in my car. I didn't sleep at all this night, and there were quite a few nights where I was just, you know, diagnosed insomnia post this, you know, incident. It was just my circadian rhythms and everything were completely shot. I hadn't been sleeping at all, and the substance abuse didn't help that, even though I was trying to use it to help. Look, the clock ticked around to 5 a.m. and I was, you know, in a state of, you know, fairly substantial panic that the day was starting again. I remember this just overwhelming, like, tsunami of emotion around not being able to see the sunrise. It was like I had this blockage that I literally just remember thinking, I can't do another day. It's impossible. It's an impossibility. I'm that exhausted. I literally have no energy left. Like, if I could have like pushed a button and evaporated, I just would have, you know, like I can't do it anymore.
Well, it sounds like you were going through a living hell, like not being able to sleep, sleeping in your car, going through so much and not being able to tell someone. I can't even imagine the kind of pressure building inside you and what that must have felt like.
Yeah, it was like it was awful. And, you know, at this point, I don't want to say people because I don't know other people's experience, but I feel from stories I read, you know, someone who is suicidally depressed at that point, you feel so alone and something happens to your brain, certainly for me. So my thoughts were telling me that I was convinced that I had no one. I really now don't really understand how that happens when I had so many people around me that cared about me. But, you know, it's, you know, depression is like poison for the brain and it really took over me completely. I felt so isolated and alone that, you know, I was compelled to take my life to stop the pain I was feeling, really. That morning, you know, I walked up to the Harbour Bridge and scaled the fence and, you know, walked for about 350 metres on a very thin railing, not caring whether I fell or not.
So on the other side of the big safety wires?
Yeah, so I climbed over at the rocks, where the sandstone wall is. And this is, none of this is really planned. It's all kind of in the moment, like not super premeditated.
Was there any reason that you chose the Harbour Bridge?
Just because of where I was. You know, I'd had suicidal thoughts for probably a month, maybe two, at least a couple of months by this point. And there had been times where I'd, you know, driven around trying to find somewhere to take my life and convince myself not to do it. So, it was just, you know, if I could have found a way to the rooftop of my building, I probably would, you know what I mean? It was just like, where am I going to go to end this pain? And in the moment, that sort of made sense. I sat down on the railing, which is difficult in itself to like sit down on a railing when you don't really have anything to lean on. But anyway, sat down there and I was kind of doing this like goodbye thing. It's a bit weird. Well, not weird, but
yeah, your brain's
thinking back.
Crazy, everything.
Yeah, and I had a fancy watch that my brother, who's 5 years younger, thought was the most amazing thing ever. You know, this designer Swiss thing that was just ridiculous. But anyway, so I took that off and I remember sitting it on the railing, thinking in my head that my brother would get my watch when I was gone. Like, it was quite intense. And in the moment that I remember this because the police officer ended up having the watch and he was wearing it because I was like, don't drop this. But this is still in my hand. As I placed the watch down and I was literally about to jump, sirens surrounded me. And before I could really think, there was a police officer on the fence only, you know, as far as we're sitting away from each other, just urging me not to jump and asking me to step off the railing against the fence so he could hold me there. You know, and we went through a pretty substantial chat and, you know, initially the police report says initially that I told him to go away, there was nothing to worry about, I was there to watch the sunrise.
So even
it's
in,
like,
did you believe, like, when you told him that, did you actually think he'd believe it?
Well, I don't know. I think I just, you know, I was trying anything to deflect my reality.
Even then.
Right? Even then. And I think that's a, you know, it just goes to show how unwell the mind gets, because it's completely irrational and obviously not going to fly. But anyway.
I just think that's so important for anyone listening who, you know, if they do find themselves in rock bottom in the next, you know, weeks, months, years, the brain is just not rational in these periods. And knowing when you're at that rock bottom, you are not yourself. This is not normal thoughts. And we've had a few people in this podcast that have had, you know, hit rock bottom like you. And this is all what they've been echoing is, you know, these just ridiculous thoughts that they would, you know, never have now and don't make sense.
When you said, Dan, you took that watch off and you, that was one thing, obviously, your brother, who you kind of wanted to leave something for him, although you're literally moments away from ending your own life. Did you have any other thoughts in that particular moment about sort of you know, what you had accomplished in your life or your family, or, you know, the pain potentially you might be causing your parents or anything like that? What was kind of other things going through your mind then?
It's not really. I was convinced that I was doing everyone a favour, which is unfortunately a really common theme, whether it be through suicide notes or survivors of suicide attempts. It's virtually the most common theme that I've picked up, and I've taken quite an interest in it. So
that's what exactly anyone who's thought about suicide on our podcast has said.
Yeah. The only other thought I had is another pretty dark and irrational one, is that I was trying to jump in the water because I thought my dead body wouldn't look as bad as if I landed on the pavement for my parents to identify my body. So I was literally thinking about them going through that experience. Like, that's how far I'd gone with my thought. Like, I was picturing myself in my thoughts deceased, but not really thinking about how they were feeling, because I was assured that I was doing them a favour. I just didn't want it to be quite as painful. It's really weird, but that was an absolute thought. That's why I'd scaled the railing for so long.
And even, I know you've shared this, your story a lot now, but even looking at that moment when, like, that's how far gone, like you said, you're effectively already dead. Mm. You were just kind of the final processes of how you're going to logistically do it. Mm. Looking back at that now, you and I know you've said this many a times, but does it just seem crazy that you're even in that place, like to think you can consider even doing that?
It really does, you know. Mate, it's a really tough thing to talk about, because I still feel for that guy so much, you know, how much pain he was going through. Like, it's so sad that people go through that, you know. I feel it for other people that are going through it, but it does seem, you know, hard for me to believe that, more so probably that I'm only less, you know, almost 6 years next month. It'll be 6 years since that event, and, you know, I'm now sitting here talking about it all, for starters, something that, you know, all these things that aren't even problems in my life now that I was about to lose my life to. You know, they're not even there, and I've gotten through so much. But more importantly, you know, I live a very full, content, happy, normal life now. I have two kids. I have an amazingly supportive partner. You know, and so I think the hardest thing for me to look back at is, you know, how scary it is that I nearly didn't have all this life. You know, there's two amazing, healthy kids in the world that are going to have incredible lives and impact so many people that almost aren't here. You know, like, that's how I look at it. I look at it and I go, like, if I died that day, they wouldn't have been born. And, you know, the gratitude is not even a big enough word, you know. Like, it's just, it's so much more than words, that feeling of, like, just, I don't know, it's just a feeling of complete overwhelm in the happy sense. Like, I'm just so overwhelmed with good feelings and happy emotions that, you know, I'm still here, you know, because I really love life now, even through the hard times. You know, like, my recovery, which I'm sure we'll touch on, has not been easy. It's probably a good segue, but it's not been easy at all. But it's been so worth it, because, yeah, like, where I am today and, you know, what I'm doing with my life and the impact I'm having, which, you know, sometimes I need to pinch myself to even think that I'm helping people through tough times by sharing my story, but they message me and tell me all the time, and it blows my mind every time. It's just a beautiful thing.
It's just so powerful to hear you say that, mate, and I think very inspiring to hear you say that, and the mindset you have now. And I suppose for the listeners who are kind of on the edge of their seats, kind of thinking, well, hang on a second, what the hell happened then? You know, it's, you know, noting we do want to sort of, you know, cover off on this other stuff, you know, your journey to wellness and kind of what you're up to now. But just to kind of finish on that, you know, my understanding is that the police officer there, Aaron, who effectively saved your life, and, you know, you guys are now quite close, and he sort of talked you through it, and you eventually got off that ledge and you know, I guess just to finish up that little part, because I feel like it's almost like a movie or something.
We've left them on the edge of their seats, yeah. So Aaron was able to convince me to step over the railing. You know, that was the moment I decided to live. You know, I was, until he sparked a bit of hope in me to live, You know, I just wanted him to go away so I could finish what I was there to do. And, you know, he said some really powerful things that no one had ever had the chance to tell me, really, to be fair, but it was the first time I'd ever been so exposed and vulnerable in my entire life. And to be so exposed in that moment, like so raw, and to have someone going, I see you, it's okay. And he was just, it was pure empathy without judgment. Like, and he was just there for me, and he was a stranger, but he was like, just felt like so connected to this guy. Like, I think it's not just police officers and first responders having a real knack. Like, I think he was the right guy for me on the day. Like, I do believe that. He was just, he was a bit of a rugged looking dude. You know, he was real Aussie accent.
You guys,
you know,
shared a cigarette, is my understanding.
Yeah, oh, yeah, that was ridiculous. Yeah, it was like, again,
this is a cigarette
is
endorsed by a doctor. It's kind of helped save your life.
Yeah,
I'll say
so
it's okay.
I was, totally. It was weird. Like, I was socially smoking at that time, you know, when I was drinking alcohol, but it was more, look, my mind wasn't really functioning that well, obviously, in this moment where I wasn't sure whether I was going to take my life or not. But I asked him if he had a cigarette, and he either did or a security guard did, but I asked him to share it with me, and he did, right? And in that moment, like, you know, he did. He was doing whatever he could to build rapport with me. And I think I was testing his, you know, whether I could trust him or not, some bizarre way. But whatever that was, it was a cigarette that we really bonded over. And literally that was kind of where I said, I remember going, mate, can you get me down from here? Like, how are you going to get me to safety? I want to live. Like, get me to hospital. What all that stuff you've been telling me about getting well, let's do it, you know. And then it was a really traumatic ordeal to get me down, which I won't bore the listeners with, but, you know, it took about another 20 minutes to work out how to get to me safely without risking putting a harness on me and me falling, because no one could get to the other side of the fence to put anything on me safely. They were going to cut the fence open, and then they ended up sort of hoisting me over with a loop harness, but it was really, felt really unsafe. I thought they were going to drop me. I got a few cuts from the barbed wire and all sorts of things. And then I was, you know, scheduled under the Mental Health Act, thankfully. Very grateful for, you know, the way that that system works.
So you went straight to hospital?
Straight to hospital under police guard in an ambulance.
And can you said that he instilled hope into you about recovery. Can you just tell us literally what some of his words were to you on the fence?
Yeah. He said things like, I've seen people come back from where you are right now. There's a lot of help out there. That's almost verbatim, I think, word for word or thereabouts. Like, I asked him, I don't remember. It's a bit of a haze the day, but I've spoken to Aaron so many times about it. He obviously has a very clear recollection of it. And there's a police report as well. But it was those words of, you know, real sincere encouragement that, you know, I wasn't nearly as far gone as I thought I was. He's like, it's going to be okay. You know, I know you're hurting right now, but we're going to get you through this. And it was all those words of we, together, us, you know, like it was really that whole I'm not alone thing. And they've got this, just the way that they frame these conversations to make you not feel like you're alone anymore. Like, it was a real connection thing. And I remember something changing and me actually feeling like a spark, like, you know. And Aaron said to me, when he first saw me, he said he'd never seen anyone so lifeless. He feels like he could look straight through me. He was like, you were like soulless. And then he felt me come back.
Unbelievable. Yeah. Even hearing you say that, but I just want to say, Aaron sounds like an absolute legend, really.
He is. Yeah,
I'm sure
he
he's almost like your guardian angel, whether or not you believe in that stuff.
Yeah, he's an amazing bloke, you know, and he's saved people from a burning car too in his career. He used to be a fiery, like, he's
I think we need to get him
hero
on the podcast.
Oh, I should have got you and Aaron on the podcast.
He's a hard man. He's a very, very humble and shy man. He's very, yeah, I haven't even done a proper interview with him. He's not into it, but he's a true hero, like, you know, many or all first responders are, and just very grateful for everyone that was there that day.
Look, let's just, you know, quickly touch on, I say quickly because look, we you know, we could probably speak to you for literally for hours and hours on end, mate. But your journey to wellness, and I suppose, you know, you went to hospital and then it was kind of that road to recovery. And I understand you've still definitely had downs through there. But ultimately, you touched on earlier in the episode when you didn't have any self-care. And now you've just learnt the importance of self-care. So I suppose where you're sitting today and the journey to wellness and that road to recovery, what are some the things you've learnt about self-care and things through that journey that have really helped you get mentally healthy?
Sure, yeah. So obviously a big topic, big question, as you said, but I'll try and kind of summarise it into what worked for me. So yes, I did go to hospital firstly. You know, I consulted with my first psychiatrist and psychologist and what have you. And the first few days in the PEC unit of a hospital are really full on. It's not a place that you want to stay very long. You know, but then going to, you know, a private hospital for about 4 weeks, I ended up staying there, mental health facility. I got a lot of great care and really started to understand what mental health was all about, understanding, you know, my diagnosis and what I was going through and, you know, education on managing that. So I think a big part of it was the medication, the initial medication and education that I got in hospital, and a lot of that initial therapy around the trauma that I'd just been through, because obviously there was a lot of initial trauma just around the fact that I'd gone so close to taking my life. And but then from there, the journey has been, I've really tried anything and everything. I eat super healthy for gut health. I've really researched and understand what works for me there. I really prioritize sleep, the really simple ones, and exercise.
I'd be interested just very quickly summarizing in your opinion, you know, what is the advice for people on the other side who know, you know, they know a loved one is struggling, they are in a difficult situation. What's your advice to them on what they can do?
Yeah, obviously a hugely important piece of the puzzle and a really tough one, I think. Firstly, you know, if you know someone in your life is struggling, it's really hard to know how to reach them, you know, how to approach that, because it can be sensitive, certainly if they're not open about their struggles. So if you've never spoken to that person about the fact they're struggling, it's really tough for that initial conversation. But obviously the very simple, are you okay, is a really good starting point. But, you know, the generally you'll get the I'm fine. You know, I was very good at that.
I was going to say, I've asked many ex-boyfriends if they're okay, and I got fine every time.
Totally. You know, and I just think following up with, you know, letting them know that, you know, if you hear I'm fine and you know they're not, I find things like, you know, if you're ever not feeling okay, just know that I'm here for you and I can always be here just to talk to, you know, that sort of thing. Because if you know someone's not well, but they're not willing to open up yet, just planting the seed and letting them know that you're going to be there for them, I think is a really nice, comforting thing for them to take away. Plants the seed for quite often, I'll then 2 or 3 days later, hey, Bryce, you know when you asked me if I was okay? And I'm like, here it is. Beautiful.
And I'm looking back at that Dan in 2014 who felt so alone. Like, I wonder if things would have been different if back then someone had said that to you.
Yeah, it may well have been. You know, if someone had really pointed to, you know, a lot of my mates have said, like, they feel like they let me down and they wish they'd known and they should have seen the signs. Like, they knew I'd slipped at the gym and I was partying too much, and, you know, but life goes by for people. It's no one's fault. But having the conversation isn't easy. But I think the thing that we need to do for people who are struggling is let them know we're there for them when they're ready, that there's a lot of help out there, and not trying to give too much advice, but just listening. Like, we hear that all the time, but we've got two ears and one mouth for a reason. In the times that people are really struggling and not opening up, when they start to, I think you just let them talk, you know, like, because quite often, you know, that's all you want to do. You just want to lay your problems out on the table, vocalize them, self-therapy, you know, it's like self-therapy, self-counseling a lot of the time.
And it's called talking therapy.
Talking therapy, yeah. And then you, you know, and then obviously encourage them to seek help, you know, just let them know there's a lot of help out there and that, you know, what they're going through is normal too. I think if you can somehow say that it's going to be okay, and if you know someone that's gone through something, it's always good to point to a hope-filled story, which is why I share my story, why you both share your stories, because people can see, find a lot of hope in those stories and share them down the line.
And as you say, mate, you know, the storm always passes. I think the people listening knowing that the Dan Price in your stage back in 2014, you wouldn't have seen that at the time, but I think that's the powerful part. You know, the advice that you can give others is, and like that Aaron, the police officer, said, I've seen people come back from where you are now and it will get better. And I think that's what you've got to hold on hope for, that it will get better. And that's something that's so so powerful and profound in your story, mate. And I think, you know, before we do start to finish up, you know, otherwise we'll probably have to make this a part two, which we would love to do. But mate, maybe another time we get you and Aaron back.
Sure.
That'd be good.
Try.
But let's talk about Movember very quickly. It is the month of Movember. It's obviously very close to all three of our hearts. And it's an important campaign. The slogan this year is "The most important mow you'll ever grow." So I think it's important to touch on why this year is so important. So why, you know, compared to other years, why is this year of Movember and why everyone should be getting around Movember this year?
Yeah, look, I think it's pretty obvious that this year has probably been the toughest year that all of us have been around collectively. It's just bizarre and it's affected so many people. We know, and I think a lot of people are aware that mental health presentations at mental health facilities and hospitals are through the roof.
And really sadly, the average number of suicides per day has gone up.
I saw Zach from Movember. He shared that as well.
It was six men per day and now the average is seven.
Yeah, which, you know, is obviously tragic and it's, you know, it's a bit disheartening for us too, doing so much work in the space. Well, I certainly feel that, but unfortunately, there are some very big factors outside of everyone's control. So we just need to band together and do more and do what we can. And one thing we can do is support Movember and grow a mo. And, or, you know, if we're a chick, plenty of other things you can do. You don't have to try and grow a mo because that'd be a bit weird.
But I have my 20 full year mo on my finger.
You get your tattoo.
And on that, mate, what are you you personally doing? Obviously, you and Izzy basically love running, which I think the listeners know by now. Izzy's obsessed with running.
And I just realised, Hugo, we still haven't talked about the fact that I was going to train you up for a marathon. It hasn't happened.
That's okay.
God damn it.
Life got in the way. Can't put pressure on ourselves. We're busy people, plenty of time. But Pricey, mate, what are you doing this year for Movember?
Yeah, so just carrying on from my Movember last year. Last year, coming out of hospital, I joined the 440 Run Club, and I realised in hospital that I needed to get that healthy community back in my life. So I did that, and then off the back of that, I ran 60Ks on the last day of Movember as an ultra marathon. It was my first one. I'd never run over 30Ks and had a huge community outreach of support. That's how I met Izzy. She ran 30Ks with me. It was just an epic day. So it made sense for me to do a similar thing again, to get the community around it, to get a lot of my mates growing mows, running, moving for Movember, getting healthy, donating, connecting. It's all good stuff. You know, community, connection and conversation are like the three C's of my ultra run. So this year I'm doing something pretty big, which is 126.6. It's three marathons in one run. I'll run from Bondi to Palm Beach.
126.
Yeah,
I just want the listeners to hear that 126. You didn't mishear. It's not 26.
Yeah. So, I was doing this thing where I was mapping. I was mapping what a point to point is, because when you tell people you're running from Bondi to Palm Beach and back, they go, "Yeah, that's pretty far." But on a map, you know, because you're doing the out and back, it doesn't look that far. But it would be like me running from my home in Bondi to Bowral. So it's a long way.
I don't think I've run 126 kilometres in my life.
I've heard that a few times.
But that's honestly probably not an exaggeration. Like walking and stuff, maybe. Sure. But the fact you're doing 126 kilometres in one run is pretty hectic. And how's the training going for that, mate?
Yeah, look, it's been 4 months of prep. It's not a small feat to do it properly.
That's a good point. For people listening, don't just listen to this and go, you know what, I'm just going to run 126Ks tomorrow because it might not be safe.
I've dedicated 4 months of, you know, 4 or 5 days a week of running and a lot of other stuff.
And just had a baby in the middle of that.
Yeah, baby too. So look, it's been tough, and very supportive partner Sarah at home, obviously letting me go and run sometimes on weekends. I try and fit my long runs in the morning real early, so I'm not away from the family
much.
But
balance, you know?
Yeah, trying to balance it out as best I can. But obviously she's very supportive because she knows how important this is for me and the community too, because, you know, it helps a lot of people get moving.
And where can we find all this run stuff, mate? Where can we find you and the run?
Yeah, so just through my Instagram, obviously. In my bio at the moment, I've got my Mobro page, and there's info on there.
What is your Instagram? Sorry, mate.
It's Dan Pricey, Danprice85. So Danprice85.
And if people were interested in joining for some segments, would that be something you'd be open to?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so it's completely inclusive. That's what it's all about. Anyone can run any distance. Like literally, last year I had a few people that just ran the Bondi Promenade. You know, just a few hundred meters, just to be part of it, because they weren't runners or they had a little injury. And a lot of people are training up. A lot of our friends and mates, I've got a couple of really good mates doing or hoping to do the whole thing with me, which is amazing. I'll be posting closer to the date the actual checkpoints, but we're breaking the run down, not to say that you need to run a 15 or 20K leg, but there'll be checkpoints and aid stations where we stop for refuel and water and food.
Mate, I'll be cheering you on the sidelines, I promise you that.
So it'll be a really good day. I expect probably anywhere from 50 to, you know, maybe 70, 80 people run different sections with me across the day, because we are talking a whole probably 14-hour period, I'd say. Something like that, 12 to 14 hours.
Love it, mate. It's a fantastic thing. And for people listening wanting to get involved in Movember, they certainly can by growing a Mo, by fundraising, by donating, and absolutely donating. We'll have some links for where you can donate. But, you know, this is the way Pricey is doing it. And it's incredible what you're doing. And it's an amazing feat. And you should be bloody proud of the accomplishment that you're setting out to achieve. But for people listening, everyone's got different ways of what they want to do, whether that be running or walking or
there's
swimming
a 60 kilometer move challenge, which is 60 kilometers over the month of November. You can walk, you can jog, anything, but you know, that's 60 is to represent the 60 men we, you know, tragically lose to suicide every hour. Or you can, you know, have a morning tea, anything.
Yeah, so there's lots of ways. And if you go on Movember.com, and Movember obviously a massive sort of partners with this podcast, Movember.com, they've got all the different information there. So can't wait to follow that journey with you, mate. It's going to be simply incredible.
I was going to say, the important thing as well I love to talk about is, yes, we're fundraising money, but this is all about conversations. This year it's been a financially tough year for a lot of people. I'm putting an event on and, yes, I'd like to raise a bit of money, but mainly I really want there to be some great conversations happening. And Dan, I think in your long run, there's definitely going to be some good conversations come from that.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's the beauty of it. You know, running the long distance, but at a slightly slower pace, you have the ability to have a chat. And last year there were some incredible shares and stories that came out of it. And yeah, I expect the same. But like you said, Hugo, you know, you don't need to run 126 Ks or anything like that to contribute and be a part of Movember. You know, there's no donation or no movement too small. You know, if you just want to get out and start walking your dog around your block every day and have a conversation, maybe chat to some dog owners at the park about what Movember means to you, like, you know, you just got to start conversations, as Izzy said.
Yeah, it's so important, mate. And on that, the final part of the podcast, we just want to sort of the behind the uniform challenge. And hopefully you're not going to say the challenge from now until next week is to run 126 Ks, because I think that's a bit unrealistic. But is there a challenge that you can set us and the listeners that, you know, something that's tangible, something that we can try and achieve from now until next week?
Yeah, I'd look, my biggest self-care thing that I lean on is meditation. And I'd love to.
Damn, I knew a guest was going to say that at one point, and you're the one.
Yeah,
I've tried so many times.
There's so many great apps. And what I would say to that, just like finding a good psychologist, finding a meditation style that works for you can be tough.
That is good
stick
advice. Any particular app you could recommend?
So I actually, I do a Vedic meditation now. So it's a mantra meditation that I do without an app, but I've gotten there over a long period of time. But Headspace Insight Timer is a really good one, because it has a lot of sleep music and sleep meditations too. I think if you're not a morning meditator and you struggle to get to sleep, an evening meditation to get you off to sleep is great. And this Insight Timer is free, and it'll turn off when the thing's done. So you literally just sit your phone on your bedside, it does the meditation, you'll fall asleep, and then your phone will just turn off.
Done. Awesome. That can be the challenge for us, Iz. And I like the concept of it. It's all different, but we'll both be downloading Insight Timer. And if you're listening right now and you want to play along, Insight Timer, as Dan said, it can take a long time to get to where he is now for meditation. So if you're a beginner with meditation,
it's like your fitness.
Beginner meditation, which I am. I really want to get into it. So I'm going to download Insight Timer. I'm going to put the thing on before bed and see how I go.
There you go.
So I like it. Iz, you on board? Don't have a choice.
Of course I am.
No, I love it. Look, Dan, thanks so much. It's a simply inspiring story from, you know, starting way back to the start of this episode when you were 7 and the isolation and difficulties you had growing up, growing through school, your teenage years, you know, your early 20s from the pinnacle of what people perceive as success to then kind of hitting rock bottom, to that incident on the Sydney Harbour Bridge in 2014 where you were literally seconds away from ending your own life, to kind of, you know, transforming to where you are now through self-care. You've got two wonderful children, a supportive wife, and you're doing amazing things for Movember in the mental health space, mate. And it's simply incredible to be here today and to hear that transformation. And it's awesome, I think. You know, some of those key takeaways simply is sort of, you know, you're not alone is so important. Yeah, so, absolutely. Dan, mate, thanks so much for sharing your story with
us. You're welcome. No, thanks very much for having me on, guys. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks so much, Dan. I think this is an episode where our listeners will definitely get take a lot home from. So thanks so much.
And good luck with that 126Ks,
mate. Yeah, I'll be sore. Thanks, guys. Cheers.